Dear counsel, the case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Russolo against the United States. Mr. Dion, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The sole issue that is being presented today is the scope of the RICO forfeiture statute that was passed by Congress in 1970, in particular, Section 1963A1. We'll try to, in the oral argument, not get into a bingo contest. Unfortunately, a lot of the sections in 1962 and 1963 are interrelated, and most of the argument is going to deal with the interrelationship of those two statutes. First of all, the simple question is whether or not the term interest in 1963A1 permits the forfeiture of income proceeds and profits of illegal racketeering activity, or whether it does not so include it. The first thing that we need to do, of course, is go to the express wording of the statute. As in many of these cases of statutory construction, both the government and the defense have argued that the express wording, as well as the intent of the legislature and the legislative history, supports their respective positions. If we take a look first at the express wording of 1963A1, it's important to note, as several courts have held. In particular, I'd like to bring to this court's attention the case of United States versus McManigal, which was decided after the briefs were filed, which is out of the Seventh Circuit. Each of those courts have held that it is of interest that the actual word income, profits, and proceeds are not expressly included in 1963A1. It's important for two reasons. One of the reasons that is relied upon, that I think is secondary, is the inclusion of the words in the CCE statute 848, which was decided and passed within 2 weeks of the passage of the RICO statute. And in fact, in that statute, in the forfeiture provisions, Congress did in fact specify the forfeiture of proceeds. However, I believe that's secondary. I think first we have to look at the actual RICO statute itself. If we take a look at 1962A.
Where do we find that, Mr. Dine, in the papers? Where do we find 1962A in the papers?
A copy of it is in our appendix at Appendix 1, Your Honor. 1962A is most illuminating in that in that section, Congress did in fact use the term interest, did in fact use the term income, and did in fact independently use the word proceeds. Now, the government's argument, at least one of the positions, was that when Congress includes language in one section of the statute and doesn't include it in another section, there must be a reason. We obviously do not disagree with that at all in this context. In 1962A, Congress used the terms income, proceeds, and interest differently, knew that the terms were different, and as exemplified in the CCE statute, when they wished to make it forfeitable, they said it was forfeitable. The question then comes up to what is the interest that is included in 1963A1? What are we talking about? I'd like to first take a shortcut. One of the things that the government relies upon is a dictionary definition of the term interest. And one of the dictionary, but not the legal definition, but the common Webster's Dictionary or American Heritage Dictionary definition, is that it includes the term profit. I'd like the court to understand what they mean by profit in that definition of the word interest. When you go to a bank and you take out a loan and you pay money to the bank for that privilege, the interest is the profit that the bank is making. It's not the same context as the dictionary definition in a legal sense. Black's Law Dictionary defines it differently. That is the definition that was used by the Martino dissent, by the Phoebus Court, and by the McManigal Court. The most general term that can be employed to denote a right, claim, title, or legal share in something. This is where a lot of the lower courts went out and said, all right, if it's an interest in something, what is the something that we are talking about? And a number of the courts, including a new case that was decided by the Tenth Circuit since this court was, case was submitted, United States versus Zhang, has said, let us look at the RICO statute in its entirety. What is it that makes the RICO statute different from other criminal statutes? What is it that we are attempting to punish? Since obviously this is a form of enhancement. It is a form of, we take the substantive crime, and if they've done it more than one time and other elements are there, we now have a new crime which we have construed in 1970 called RICO. And that something in addition is in fact the enterprise concept. So these courts have gone on to say that when we talk about an interest in something, the something we're talking about is the enterprise. They then go back and take a look at the actual wording of the statutes. In 1962, and other than in one place in 1963, which is the source of litigation here today, whenever Congress used the term interest, it said interest in an enterprise. Now, one of the questions that the government has raised is why then in 1963A1 does Congress not say interest in an enterprise when in 1963A2 and elsewhere throughout the statute they say interest in, and then the government conveniently says three or four dots, an enterprise? Well, I would submit that the reason that it is included in A2 and not in A1 is what's missing, what those dots represent. We would submit that when Congress has already stated throughout the substantive offense that it is an interest in an enterprise, that there was no need to put the words interest in an enterprise in 1963A at all, but that the reason they did it in A2 was to make very clear not that the interest which is forfeitable is the interest in the enterprise, but rather that the security of, claim against, or property or contractual right of any kind affording a source of influence over is modified by the term any enterprise, since those terms are not used elsewhere in the statute with the said modification. A lot of the courts and some of the law review articles condemn the courts for this, then go into a question of legislative history. And as with many of these cases, both the government and the defense submit that the legislative history supports their respective positions. There is a slight difference, however. If the court would take a look at the references that the government has made to support their concept of legislative history, they are statements, speeches, and parts of the record, congressional record, that reflect the opinions of individual senators and members of the House. It is not the position of the entire Congress that passed the statute. And that's the intent that we're going for if we're going to look at legislative history. We, on the other hand, rely upon primarily the preamble to Senate Bill 30, which was 1963, became 1963, which expressly limits the forfeiture of interest in an enterprise. Also, the Senate reports and House reports, which were the synopses and the explanations that were given to the senators and the congressmen when they, in fact, were required to vote on the statute. When they said, what is this all about, That's what they were looking at.
Mr. Dunn, you say that the government relies on speeches by individual senators and House members, and you rely on synopses and a preamble. Neither of you rely on the words of the statute itself.
Well, both of us rely initially on the wording of the statute, and both submit that the express wording supports their respective positions. Needless to say, unfortunately, it can't. So obviously there is a conflict and a question of what the expression means.
At that point, you go to the secondary.
That is when both sides go to the secondary. Obviously, the express wording is a primary concern, and the legislative history is really a secondary source of interpretation.
Mr. Dionne, with respect to Congress's stated purpose, which, as I understand it, was to eradicate organized crime, why in the world would Congress have wanted to exempt from forfeiture cash profits that are the primary product of an illegal enterprise? I think your argument is a little strange in that regard.
Well, there are primarily two reasons, Your Honor. The first question is a policy determination that really needs to be addressed by Congress, and I believe has been addressed. And that is a question of, we have now punished the racketeer by throwing him in jail. We have punished the racketeer by separating him from his office in the enterprise and separating him from his interests in the enterprise. We have now fined the individual. Now we get to the question of the forfeiture aspect. Who is it that we wish to protect? Who should be the benefactor of the forfeiture?
Well, wasn't it Congress's whole purpose to make a crime unprofitable?
Of course it was.
And if you don't forfeit the profits, how do you do that?
Well, there are two answers. The first one is that it still is forfeitable. Not only is it forfeitable under civil law, it is subject to treble damages. I believe it was a question of policy of, if we're going to take the criminal out of the enterprise, who should get the benefit of the forfeiture? Should it be the government or the victim? That's one answer. The other one is a little bit more technical, and unfortunately it is supposition, since no one can really tell. I would respectfully submit that one of the problems that Congress had was that when they passed the first United States in personam forfeiture action, they were most concerned with the constitutionality of the act. And I believe that when they sent, or in particular the Senator McClellan, requested Attorney General Kleindienst to answer the question of the constitutionality, and now we're getting into the Kleindienst letter, and I believe this is one of the true reasons and importances of the Kleindienst letter.
That letter referred to a different version of the bill that was eventually enacted.
It was a predecessor of the 1963. However, the importance of the statute, of the letter at this juncture, is that when Congress said, is it constitutional? Kleindienst responded, yes, it's constitutional as limited. As limited to interest in the enterprise, and as limited so that no other property is subject to forfeiture. And I think it really came down to a very simple question. Congress was afraid that if they extended the forfeiture beyond the limitations which were imposed by that letter, that they would be getting into an area of constitutional dimension. And in order to avoid it, they went into the civil remedies and the civil treble damage forfeitures that were provided. There's another aspect of the Kleindienst letter I believe that's important. The importance of the Kleindienst letter is not the opinion of the Attorney General that it is limited, forfeitures are limited to interest in an enterprise, because as Your Honor correctly pointed out, that applied to a prior forfeiture proceeding. The importance of it is that it was included in Senate Bill 30 in the preamble to show the intent of the Senate in passing the bill, the intent of the limitation being there. So it is Congress's intent by using the letter in their preamble and referring to it that's important, not the Attorney General's personal opinion.
Mr. Dionne, looking again at the language of 1963A as it appears in your brief at the second page of the appendix. Well, what is the difference in operation between subsection, what does subsection 2 hit that subsection 1 doesn't, and vice versa?
The defendant would respectfully submit that what A1 hits are what are referred to in a couple of the cases as passive investments, while A2 hits active investments. A2 in particular goes to those things which afford a source of control over an enterprise.
Does that modify all of the terms, interest in, security of, claim against? Are all of those modified by the language affording a source of control of influence over?
Unfortunately, I'm not a grammarian. However, several of the lower courts have so indicated they believe that that limitation does apply across the board, if not expressly, as an indication of the intent of the entire section.
Well, is the reach of one somehow narrower than two?
It's not a question of being narrower or not. I believe that the government's interpretation would make one narrower than the other. I believe they actually go to different things. For example, let's assume that you have a situation where an individual is involved in a racketeering situation and he has interest in an enterprise that is less than of a substantial source of influence over the enterprise. That would not be subject to forfeiture under A2, yet that certainly is not the intent of Congress. The intent of Congress is to totally separate him from the legitimate enterprise entirely. That would be subject to forfeiture under A1. There are other things that would be subject to forfeiture under A1 that would not be subject under A2. For example, in the Godoy case out of the Ninth Circuit, the profits and proceeds were then reinvested as part of the enterprise into investment property. That was subject to forfeiture under A1.
What then does A2 reach that A1 doesn't?
A2 primarily would reach not only interest in the enterprise, which give a source of influence, which would also arguably be covered under A1, but it also allows the forfeiture of the securities, the claims, property, and contractual rights, all of which are a form of influence that arguably is not subject to forfeiture under A1. I think it's not really a question of is A1 and A2, let's categorize them separately. It's a question of why are they there. In the prior
surely when Congress is writing in one single paragraph that someone shall forfeit to the United States, one and then a sentence and then two a sentence, we assume that Congress has two different, it was striking at two different things, or it would have put it all in one sentence.
Of course, Your Honor. Initially, they did have it all in one sentence. As a matter of fact, A1 was the initial sentence. Congress then ran into a problem, I would submit, in thereafter they passed the modification of 1962A, where they included the 1% exception. And I agree with the government, that does not make it not forfeitable. However, Congress was afraid that someone might so interpret it. And to avoid that possibility, they more fully set forth the different categories that now make up A1 and A2 of 1963, which was not there before. Actually, though, it attempted to make it a little bit more difficult to understand. I think their intent really was to try to simplify it, and they just didn't succeed, unfortunately.
I wonder if you misspoke or if I was incorrectly advised, but was it not A2 that was originally in the statute, A1 that was added later?
I do not believe so. I believe A1 was the original. The original...
Because the original draft, I thought, was expressly limited to interest in an enterprise.
And that is correct. That's A1.
Oh, that's A2.
Excuse me. Let me rephrase that. The original was actually, I apologize, it was a modification of A1 and A2. The original was interest in an enterprise, which they did not then separate in any way, shape, or form, and then they broke it down into A1 and A2.
And now the words in an enterprise appear in A2, but not in A1.
And I would submit that they are in A2 for the express purpose of modifying the other sections of A2, which were not in the predecessor proposed statute.
Is it correct that under your reading, and I'm not suggesting it's not tenable, but you in effect read in the words in an enterprise in A1, and you also treat the violation of Section 1962 language as though it said violation of Section 1962 A or B? You don't really, as I understand your argument, deal with the possibility that A1 may cover, may refer to 1962 C.
This is where I disagree with some of the lower courts that have ruled in my favor. I absolutely believe the 1963 A1 will reach an enterprise, in fact, under 1962 C. Godoy, I think, is a perfect example of that. To be most honest, this case, but for the judgment of acquittal, would have been a perfect example of that. In this case, the individual was charged primarily with being involved in a racketeering situation where he, along with others, purchased property. In his case, he already had the property, donated the property to the enterprise, got it insured, burned it, took the proceeds. What would be forfeitable in this case, but for the judgment of acquittal that was granted below, would be the property, because the property was donated to the purpose, to serve the purpose of the enterprise. This is an example of a 1962 C violation, or something would be forfeitable under 1963 A1. So no, I do not agree with the lower courts, even the ones that decided in my favor, limitation that 62 C does not apply to the forfeiture of A1.
You're saying that if the government's, if you lose, that the entire property would have been forfeitable.
That is correct.
Not just the profit from the illegal activity.
The property would have been forfeitable because it was donated and used by the enterprise. Yes, sir. I think one of the important things to take into consideration here is the fact that we are going into the area of policy determination. Should it or should it not be forfeitable? I would agree with the government wholeheartedly.
You say, Mr. Dean, that here we are going into the area of policy formulation. Does that mean, in effect, we throw up our hands and say, we have no idea what Congress wanted as between these two choices, so we'll just have to pick what seems to us the better one?
Exactly the opposite. My next sentence was going to be that policy determination should not be made here, that what we're doing here is interpreting the words of the statute, and that is what we are limited to. The only thing that I'm trying to bring to the Court's attention from a policy standpoint is the fact that even Congress across the street doesn't know really what it wants to do. The purpose of including in the brief a number of House bills and Senate bills that have come up for consideration after the passage of 1963 is not to show what Congress's intent was back in 1970. Obviously, that's impossible. What it's to show is the importance of the policy decision which Congress should be making. And even they at this point don't know which way they want to go. And the reason they don't know is, number one, the question of the constitutionality, and number two, the question of who should benefit from the forfeiture. Are society's needs sufficiently met by throwing the racketeer in jail, giving them a fine, and separating them from the enterprise, and giving treble damages to the victims? Or do we also need the additional forfeiture?
Well, what is the constitutional problem?
Personally, I don't see one.
I don't either.
Personally, I think they have every right to do it, Your Honor.
Well, were you raising that as the policy question? Is that what you meant by the policy?
What I basically meant is, going back to 1970, I think it was a policy determination because they didn't know, being the first type statute that went in personam, they didn't know whether it was going to be declared constitutional or not, and they were trying to limit their actions by the limitations that the Attorney General had given them. I think the policy determination now, which Congress ultimately is going to have to make, is strictly a question of which way are we going to go, or both ways. Is there going to be a forfeiture to the government? Is there going to be treble damages to the victim so that his business, his enterprise, can get back on its feet once the racketeer has been removed? Or is it best served by doing both?
Why does that concern the judicial process?
Absolutely should not concern this court, Your Honor. Absolutely should not. It's a decision that should be made across the street.
That doesn't help much.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. As Justice O'Connor observed, Congress's stated objective in enacting the RICO statute was nothing less than, quote, eradication of organized crime by, among other things, providing enhanced sanctions and new remedies. It's worth noting that in the preface to the RICO statute, Congress, the entire Congress, stated that its objective was to do this and found, quote, that organized crime in the United States is a highly sophisticated, diversified, and widespread activity that annually drains billions of dollars from America's economy by unlawful conduct and the illegal use of force, fraud, and corruption. Organized crime derives a major portion of its power through money obtained from such illegal endeavors as syndicated gambling, loan sharking, the theft and fencing of property, the importation and distribution of narcotics and other dangerous drugs, and other forms of social exploitation. Given Congress's objective and its finding, it would have been surprising if Congress had enacted a racketeering forfeiture statute, but had held back from authorizing the forfeiture of the illegal profits that constitute organized crime's lifeblood and the source of its wealth and power. Neither petitioner, nor the dissent in the court below, nor any court or commentator has been able to identify any convincing reason why Congress might not have wanted to authorize the forfeiture of racketeering profits. Certainly there is nothing harsh or unfair about doing so, about requiring a convicted criminal to give up his illegal gain. In this case, for example, petitioner obtained some $340,000 in insurance proceeds by taking out fire insurance on his property and arranging for an arsonist to burn it down. There's no reason why he should be permitted to keep that money. What reasons has petitioner suggested this morning?
May I ask a question right there? What exactly is it that you contend should be forfeited to the United States as opposed to what the insurance company might get back? Say, I take it the insurance company might have a claim to this money too.
Well, that's right, Justice Stevens, but there's no contradiction there. Under 1963C, the Attorney General is directed to dispose of forfeited property, making due provision for the rights of innocent persons. And under the procedures that are incorporated into RICO, a victim of racketeering can apply to the Attorney General to receive the forfeited property and can receive that property. So there's no contradiction.
So the end result would be the same, that the government would act as, in effect, would forfeit the property and then turn it back to the insurance company.
That's correct, and that's of considerable benefit to victims. It spares them the trouble and expense of bringing suit, and it also spares them the unpleasant prospect of having to square off in court against a defendant who may be a notorious racketeer.
But actually, the money ends up, I understand what you're saying about the undesirability of bringing the litigation, but assuming that the rights were enforced by civil litigation, the net result would really be pretty much the same anyway, wouldn't it?
Well, Congress intended...
At least in this case.
That's correct, Justice Stevens. Congress intended for both of those remedies to be available, and they both serve...
If the government brings the suit, Mr. Alito, are treble damages available, though?
No, the government simply gets a forfeiture.
And if the victim did, the victim would get treble damages.
That's correct. I think they are independent procedures.
Could the victim bring a suit for treble damages even after the government had imposed a civil forfeiture?
Well, that's not settled, Justice O'Connor. I would think that perhaps the money received from the government would be taken into account in computing the victim's damages, but that's
not resolved.
That's not resolved and certainly isn't the question.
While I have you interrupted, would you be good enough to give me examples of what you think would be covered under A2 in your interpretation that wouldn't already be covered in A1? It's just hard to make perfectly clear what those two subsections were intended to cover under your view.
Well, one critical difference between the two provisions is that under A1, as we read that statute, the interest must be illegally obtained. It's an interest acquired or maintained in violation of Section 1962. Under 1963A2, the interest need not be illegally obtained. It may be a lawfully acquired interest in an enterprise that the defendant has established, conducted, controlled, or participated in violation of the RICO statute. 1963A1 is really the less controversial provision of the forfeiture statute because it talks about illegally obtained interest. 1963A2 goes further and takes interests that may be lawfully obtained but have been associated with an enterprise that has been found to be unlawful. And that goes to the Kleindienst letter.
That isn't really quite right, is it? Because in A2, if you maintain an interest of that kind, it's in violation of Section 1962. And A1 covers not only acquisition, but also maintaining an interest. And I think you just forgot about the word maintained in A1. Any interest maintained in violation of 1962 is forfeitable under A1. And it seems to me all of your examples under A2 are interests that would be maintained unlawfully.
Justice Stevens, if maintained is read in that broad way, and I'm not aware of judicial authority for that proposition, then they may overlap to a substantial extent. But it's not at all obvious to me that maintained means exactly that, that maintained means any interest in an enterprise that has found to be unlawful. It could be read much more narrowly to talk about an interest that has been sustained by racketeering activity in the sense that only through that racketeering activity was the interest permitted to survive. Your reading is certainly a possible one, but I don't know that it certainly isn't settled that that's what Congress intended.
Could you give a concrete example, then, of what you think would be covered by A2 that is not covered by A1?
I think that if someone had a lawful business and fell upon financial hard times and turned to racketeering to keep the business going or as a sideline to make extra profit, that would clearly be an interest that's forfeitable under A2. It is much less clear that that would be reached by A1.
In the language of A1,
I don't know that that is a necessary reading of A1. I think it's important to point out that in A1 and A2, Congress was not crafting pieces of a puzzle that fit together neatly. I think Congress was attempting to cover the field, as it was in many of the provisions of the RICO statute. So there is a considerable overlap in these provisions. I don't think anyone, although they have tried mightily, have succeeded in construing the two provisions in such a way that they interlock with no overlap. I think there is a considerable amount of overlap.
But are you satisfied that, in your view, A1 covers some things that A2 doesn't, and A2 covers some things that A1 doesn't?
Certainly, A2 covers, yes, Justice Rehnquist, that's certainly true. A1 covers.
You've suggested one example. I still am not clear on what else you have in mind.
Well, under our interpretation, A1 covers any interest, whether or not, in an enterprise. And A2 is limited to interest in an enterprise. I think that's what Congress clearly intended.
Well, but A1 would pick up that, wouldn't it?
A1 is, as I've said, covers any interest as that term has been defined in
common
use.
So you don't need A2?
No.
You can pick up everything under A1 if I'm understanding you correctly.
I don't think that's true unless you read into the word maintained everything that is included in A2. And I don't think that it's clear that Congress intended that.
I suppose maintained in A1 could mean the situation where the thing was begun lawfully, so that you couldn't say it was acquired in violation of 1962, but then it gets unlawful in the course of operating it.
I think that's right, Justice Rehnquist. One may have an interest in a lawful enterprise, and they use that enterprise to facilitate racketeering activity. And it may be that the racketeering activity does not further the enterprise, but the enterprise furthers the racketeering activity. That results in a forfeiture under A2 and would not fall within the meaning of the word maintained under A1. Petitioner suggested this morning that one of the reasons Congress held back from authorizing the forfeiture of racketeering profits was because they entertained some constitutional doubts about their ability to do so. But he quickly concedes that he doesn't see any constitutional problem. And it's noteworthy that this provision of the continuing criminal enterprise statute upon which he relied and which was enacted during the same term of Congress authorized the forfeiture of illegal income derived from a continuing criminal enterprise engaged in drug activities. In passing that statute, Congress had no constitutional doubts, and so it is far-fetched, I would suggest, to argue that Congress had unexpressed constitutional doubts of very dubious validity about authorizing the forfeiture of the RICO statute. He argued that Congress may have held back from authorizing the forfeiture of racketeering profits because it thought that the civil remedies were enough. But this is unconvincing for a number of reasons. First, in many cases, narcotics, gambling, prostitution, there may be no identifiable victims to come forward and bring civil suit. And the result is that the racketeer gets to keep his illegal gain even though he's been convicted of participating in a criminal offense. The only argument he raised in his brief and the only argument that was raised by the dissent below for why Congress might not have wanted to authorize the forfeiture of racketeering profits is that our society, he says, has traditionally abhorred in personam forfeitures. But this argument is not good for at least two reasons. First of all, as I said, whatever attitudes were in the past, there's little doubt that the Congress that passed the RICO statute did not abhor in personam forfeitures because it enacted an in personam forfeiture statute both in RICO and in the continuing criminal enterprise statute. The RICO provision that is not challenged here, 1963A2, authorizes the forfeiture of interests that may have been lawfully obtained. And therefore, that is a far more extreme position than the forfeiture of illegally obtained gains. Yet it is not disputed that Congress wanted to do that. The second reason why this argument is not convincing is that it simply is not true that in personam forfeitures have been historically disfavored. What was outlawed by the Constitution and by the first Congress was a particular harsh type of in personam forfeiture, what was known at common law as forfeiture by attainder, under which the convicted felon was pronounced legally dead and he lost all of his property and he lost the right to transmit property to his heirs. Now, just because that was felt to be too harsh, it certainly doesn't follow that the same is true of all in personam forfeitures. On the contrary, in personam forfeiture is really less harsh than in rem forfeiture because it's a criminal proceeding. The government must satisfy the reasonable doubt standard. In rem forfeitures...
Well, you have some dicta in, for instance, the contract law of remedies, that equity abhors a forfeiture and that sort of thing. They'll read something they'll try to avoid reading as a condition that would result in forfeiture, say, by failure to complete a building on time.
Well, I think that's right, Justice Rehnquist, but this, I understand petitioner to be drawing a much more subtle distinction between in personam and in rem forfeitures. And I think that the argument that our society has traditionally viewed in personam forfeitures as harsher and therefore has disfavored them is simply not valid.
Is there a bright distinction between what you refer to as in rem forfeitures and in personam forfeitures?
There may not be a bright line, but taking the extreme cases, there certainly is a distinction. In rem is a proceeding against the forfeited object itself, and it doesn't require proof of the owner's fault. It may result in the forfeiture in some cases of lawfully obtained property that was used on a particular occasion for an illegal purpose, even without the owner's knowledge or consent, a boat that's used to import drugs or smuggle goods.
If I own a boat and it's forfeited in an in rem proceeding in Admiralty, I'm still without the boat at the end of the proceeding, you know, even though you call it in rem.
Well, that's exactly my point. I think that it's at least as harsh and in many ways much harsher than the in personam forfeiture that's involved here and simply results in a personal judgment against the defendant. My point is that is not to venture into the area of policy, whether it is socially desirable to forfeit racketeering profits. My point is that no one has been able to suggest why Congress might not have wanted to do this. And with that in mind, I'd like to turn to the language and the legislative history of RICO, both of which demonstrate that Congress did quite clearly intend to authorize the forfeiture of interests such as those involved in this case. Now, of course, the starting point, as petitioner observed, is the language of 1963A1 itself, which calls for the forfeiture of any interest in an enterprise, of any interest acquired or maintained in violation of 1962. Not an interest in an enterprise, any interest, and profits obtained from racketeering fall squarely within the plain meaning of this statute. Petitioner contests this on the ground that an interest means an interest in something. But that usage is only employed to draw a distinction between the interest, which is a bundle of rights, and the thing to which the interest applies, so that racketeering profits are clearly an interest in something. They're an interest in cash, in a bank account, in CDs, or the like. If the language of 1963A1 is not clear enough, then the contrast with 1963A2 is really dispositive. 1963A1 talks about any interest. 1963A2 talks about an interest in an enterprise. When Congress places a limitation like that in one subsection and omits it from another, the inference is virtually inescapable that it did so for a purpose. And I don't think it's a convincing explanation to suggest, as petitioner did here, that Congress simply wanted to save ink and did not want to have to include the modifying terms in an enterprise in 1963A1. Our interpretation is also supported by the RICO statute's definition of the term enterprise, which is not limited to legal entities, but also extends to wholly illegitimate ones, as this Court held in Turquette. Since Congress wanted to attack these enterprises, it would not make sense for it to limit its forfeiture provision in such a way as to make it ineffectual in doing so. Yet, in the case of an illegitimate enterprise, there are usually no interests in the enterprise that can be forfeited. They usually don't issue stock. And so it would not have made sense for Congress to provide solely for the forfeiture of interest in an enterprise and not the income, which is the source of organized crime's power. Petitioner relies on the use of the term income in 1962A, one of the prohibitory provisions, and states that if Congress intended to require the forfeiture of income in 1963A1, it would have used the term income there. Well, I hardly think there's a dispute about whether the term income was in Congress's vocabulary. It knew the term, but it had a good reason for using a different term in 1963A2 because while that provision reaches income, it's not limited to income. It includes many other types of real and personal property and other things that afford sources of wealth and control. And the alternative to using the broad, less specific term interest in 1963A1 would have been an enumeration of all the things subject to forfeiture.
Well, your contention then really is that interest in the term A1 means any real or personal property, tangible or intangible.
That's correct, Justice Rehnquist. The issue here, of course, is just proceeds, but we would contend that it reaches any type of real or personal property. And as petitioner himself suggested, the lower courts have held that it reaches other things, such as offices and companies and labor unions and positions that permit a racketeer to control a business or another organization.
Now, what specifically is the property that's being forfeited here, that's being forfeited by the district court order here?
The proceeds that petitioner received from the insurance companies when he submitted a fraudulent claim on the property that he himself arranged to have burned down.
Cash?
It's cash, $340,000. In a somewhat related argument, petitioner relies on the contemporaneously enacted provision of the Continuing Criminal Enterprise Statute, which, as I said, authorizes the forfeiture of illegal income derived from the kinds of enterprises with which that statute is concerned. But although it's true that these two provisions were contemporaneously enacted, they are really the handiwork of different congressional committees, and thus it's not clear that their language was placed under a microscope and compared. Moreover, the language is fully consistent. In the CCE statute, Congress was concerned with a single narrow type of enterprise, an enterprise that is engaged in drug activities. These enterprises usually generate large cash profits, and there usually is not an interest in the enterprise that can be forfeited. So Congress used the narrow term income. In RICO, Congress was concerned with a different problem, with a vast variety of enterprises and with more than 30 specific kinds of enumerated criminal conduct, and so it used the broader term interest. Moreover, if it's true, as petitioner suggests, that Congress carefully compared these two provisions, that supports our argument and not his. As I said, no one has suggested any reason why Congress might not have wanted to authorize the forfeiture of racketeering profits. The only possible explanation is mere oversight. And alerted by the CCE provision to the availability of this potent weapon, it doesn't make sense to suggest that Congress would have omitted it from the RICO statute without at least some discussion or debate. Yet that is what petitioner's position must be.
But the other side of the coin, if I might interrupt, is that I gather they included or they added subsection 1 without any particular explanation or debate focusing on that subsection. Isn't that true? That's one of our problems, in fact.
That's certainly true, Justice Stevens, but where Congress does something that is fully consistent with its intent, I think that is less in need of an explanation than when Congress is charged with doing something that runs directly counter to its broad intent, and that's what petitioner.
Well, except for the fact, I mean, this is a very tricky case, and I must confess to being very puzzled by it, but except for the fact that, as Justice Rehnquist has suggested, if you were talking about any property of any kind in the way of profits, it would seem to me that Congress would have been more apt to use the kind of language it used in Section 848. Whereas this does have at least, there is a tenable explanation for this, namely the difference between passive and active investments in the two. And as this would pick up, which way too wouldn't, using proceeds to buy 2% of some publicly, or to buy an interest in a publicly held legitimate business. That would be forfeitable, as I understand it, under A-1, but would not be forfeitable under A-2.
Well, that's correct, Justice.
So there is some sensible explanation for his reading that does not make the two just redundant, really.
Well, we don't argue that his reading renders them completely redundant, and I think it's clear that our reading doesn't render them completely redundant. As I said, these things were intended to occupy the field and not really to interlock tightly.
The problem with his reading is you got to stick some extra words in the statute.
That's one of the problems with his reading, and another major problem with his reading, beyond the plain language of RICO, is the legislative history. And the three points I would make about the legislative history very quickly. First, there are numerous places in the legislative history where sponsors and principal advocates of RICO, not just any congressman, but the congressmen who were responsible for drafting this bill and getting it enacted, stated that one of the purposes of the forfeiture provision was to take away racketeers' illegal gains. In the Senate, Senator McClellan, who was probably the chief sponsor of the bill, stated that RICO, quote, would forfeit the ill-gotten gain of criminals where they enter or operate an organization through a pattern of racketeering activity.
Well, Mr. Alito, Do you think that you can take a senator's statement on the floor that we want ill-gotten gains forfeited and say he must have meant profits as opposed to other kinds of interests?
I think that's what ill-gotten gain means. It means illegal profit. It certainly doesn't mean, and that's certainly a much more reasonable reading than to say that it means a lawfully acquired interest in an enterprise that has been used to further a criminal purpose.
And my query was whether Senator McClellan was really focusing on the fine distinctions that perhaps the statute might have drawn when he said ill-gotten gains.
Well, it is less specific than we might have hoped, but I think it's a reasonable approximation of our argument. And this is not a single isolated statement. There are many statements in the debate to that effect, and they elicited no opposition or inquiries from other members of Congress suggesting that maybe they shouldn't go that far. Representative Poff, to give just one more example, who was perhaps the statute's chief advocate in the House, said, after conviction, the ill-gotten gains must be forfeited to the government. And the House report stated that the forfeiture provision extends, quote, to all property and interests as broadly defined which are related to the violations. And as I said, there are other statements to this effect. The second point is, as I pointed out, that forfeiting racketeering profits is entirely consistent with Congress's broad intent. And there are many specific problems that Congress was concerned with during the congressional debates that virtually cry out for the forfeiture of racketeering profits. One example are illegal businesses that organized crime has dominated, like narcotics and gambling, where there are no interests in the enterprise that can be taken in forfeiture, but striking at the illegal profits really gets at the heart of the matter. And another was the practice of taking over a legitimate business, skimming off profits and leaving it bankrupt. Forfeiting an interest in the bankrupt shell would not do any good, but taking the illegal profits that are drained off the business would be an effective remedy. And the third point that emerges from the legislative history is it is certainly true, as petitioner points out, that there are statements in the legislative history that the forfeiture provision results in the forfeiture of interest in an enterprise. But none of these statements addressed to the finally enacted version of RICO states that the forfeiture provision is limited to these interests. These are merely illustrative and not exhaustive. And as to the letter from then-Deputy Attorney General Kleindienst, upon which petitioner relies, this addressed an earlier version of the RICO statute that was limited to interest in an enterprise, and so it really sheds no light on what the finally enacted and amended version means. This letter was quoted and cited in the Senate report because of its bearing on the question of the constitutionality of the forfeiture of interests in an enterprise. And the point that Mr. Kleindienst was making was there isn't a constitutional problem when the forfeited interest is one in an enterprise that was involved in the violation and not simply an enterprise that the convicted person happened to have. In conclusion, the forfeiture of racketeering profits is an extremely important weapon in the ongoing battle against organized crime. The plain language of RICO and the legislative history show with some certainty that Congress intended to require the forfeiture of such proceeds, and we therefore urge that the judgment of the court below be affirmed.
Further, Mr. Down.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I need to respond to two things in particular that possibly were not discussed in the affirmative argument. One question is, what exactly is the difference in the purpose of in personam jurisdiction versus in rem forfeiture jurisdiction? The reason that they went over to in personam jurisdiction is twofold. Number one, unlike in rem jurisdiction, it allows for the immediate and mandatory forfeiture, totally non-discretionary. In rem, you have independent lawsuits, independent parties involved. More importantly, the reason that it was in personam is so that the 1963 forfeiture could serve its purpose and go to things that were normally not forfeitable, that are not in rem. I think the case of United States versus Rubin is the perfect example of this. The government wanted the racketeer out of the union, out of the enterprise. To do this, the Fifth Circuit said, all right, it is subject, the office is subject to forfeiture. That's not in rem. It has to be in personam. That's the reason for the in personam jurisdiction. It is all well and good for the government to say that we think profits should be forfeitable. We believe that it is an effective weapon. But that's not really what we're here to discuss. What we're here to discuss is whether it does or does not fall under the statute as written. For example, the government has gone down and listed a number of things that they believe are subject to forfeiture under RICO, which only have as its fruits, if you will.
Of course, if the language is all that clear, probably this case wouldn't be here. And I thought you said earlier in your argument in chief, that the statute is a little confusing,
it
a
is.
Little and hard to parse. And you must turn to secondary sources like the government does. Is that right?
The secondary sources certainly are illustrative. There's no question about it.
Well, so the government is entitled to turn to its secondary sources like you do.
Well, there's a question of what level. I believe that the statements of congressmen and senators on the floor really isn't secondary. It's almost in the third position. What we're relying upon is the exact wording of the bills, of the preamble to the bills and the reports, which is what the congressmen had in front of them as their understanding of the statute when they were voting on the issue.
Of course, you're not in the position of a civil litigant either, where if it's kind of evenly divided, it goes perhaps to the person without the burden of proof. You have the presumption of lenity in a criminal action in your favor, I would think.
We would submit that we do. One of the things that's interesting is the government talks about the history of the last 15 years, how now, because forfeitures are so run-of-the-mill, we can interpret them as broadly as we possibly want. However, none of those were on the books in 1970 when the issue of the intent of Congress actually came into being. They're kind of after the fact. I think one of the important things, though, is what really was the purpose of the racketeering statute. The purpose of the statute, and I don't think there's really any argument on this, is to get the racketeer out of the enterprise, to allow the enterprise to live independent of the racketeering and to survive. Very simply stated, unless the profits and proceeds are put back into an enterprise, it falls outside the scope of the statute. That's one of the reasons that we have 1962A. That is what provides for the substantive crime and ultimately the forfeiture when there is a plowing back into an enterprise of illegally obtained interest and proceeds. If the interest and proceeds are not put back into the enterprise, though it might very well be that Congress would love to get those profits and proceeds, it goes outside the purpose and scope of the racketeering statute.
Well, Mr. Dionne, you do concede that Congress, in its stated purpose, intended to eradicate organized crime, do you not?
There's no question that was their stated purpose. However, at the same time, we take a look at what are the underlying crimes. And the government basically says we've got to go after the profits and proceeds as a forfeiture of all the underlying crimes. Yet if we look at the list of underlying crimes, Congress has not provided for forfeiture of the underlying substantive crimes in many cases. Gambling and prostitution and murder, for example, have no forfeiture provisions attached to them. That's one of the reasons I would suggest that the scope and purpose of RICO is getting the criminal out of the enterprise, and that under that interpretation, the statute can be read as expressly worded without a provision for the forfeiture of income, profits, and proceeds.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll resume at 1 o'clock.